We're up to Parshat Vayera, and our parsha will take us through the first seven plagues. Dam, the Nile will turn to blood. Sfardea, it will produce frogs. Kinim, the Egyptians will be plagued with lice. Ditzach, right? The first three have the acronym Ditzach, Dam, Sfardea, Kinim. Then we have Adash, Arov, wild animals attack Egypt. Dever, pestilence, animals drop dead. Shchin, we have boils, right? So Arov, Dever, Shchin is Adash. That's the second acronym. And then we have the seventh plague. Be'achav, the first letter of that is Be'ez, is Barad. The parasha will end with the plague of hail. And between the plagues, Moshe intermittently comes to Pharaoh and says, let the Jews go. And Pharaoh promises during each plague that when it's all over, he'll let them go. And then when the time comes, he does not let them go. So that's our parsha in a nutshell. A few things are happening in this process. Hashem says, I want the world to know I run the world. So there's a message to the world. The Jewish people have to understand that Hashem runs the world. The Egyptians have to understand that Hashem runs the world. And the Jewish people have to start understanding, A, that they are not Egyptian. B, that Hashem runs the world and cares about them. C, that Hashem could do anything. D, that they have rights. So when a woman asks to borrow something, until now she thought, I can't borrow anything because it's liability to the master. What do I own? How can I borrow? And when Hashem tells them, you will borrow from the Egyptians' vessels, what Hashem is saying, you will have rights. You will have the right to borrow something, to own something, to have responsibility for something. So our parsha and the evolvement of the plagues is an evolvement philosophically. People are going to understand that the Nile isn't God, that the frog is not a God. They'll understand what's going on, that the sorcerers don't control everything. And it's an evolvement also of the people understanding that they're autonomous. They're not Egyptian. They're people unto themselves. So our parsha begins with rebuke. Moshe Rabbeinu asks Hashem, why'd you send me? Things only got worse. Now, this is the challenge of dealing with the present. The present is what we sense the most. We might have tremendous fears of the future, but we live in the moment. And so in the moment, Moshe is seeing the Jews suffering. If we told someone they would have a root canal in 2 weeks, so then they'd start worrying. If a person was told he has a root canal in 5 minutes, he'd really be worrying. If a person's sitting in the root canal, so just before the root canal, they tell him, if you want anesthesia, if you want to put out the pain, it'll cost you another 4,000 shekel. So the guy would say, I'll try it without. I see you've had a root canal before in your life. But when he's in the root canal, most people would say, let me out. Give me the painkiller. If it's 4,000 shekel or 40,000 shekel, I'll have to figure out how I'm covering it, but I can't handle this. So the moment is very alive to us. And so that's one of the challenges, because Hashem gives us perspective that's long-term. Hashem says that there's a long-term plan here, and within that long-term plan, there are moments that are tough. And in those moments, we have a challenge of how much can we stick it out when we don't understand what's going on here. I remember once we had a student here who was in the gear process, and he came in with a few other students, and after a certain period of time, one by one, all his compadres, all his friends were finishing gear, and he was left behind, and another group came in, and then that second group started finishing their gear process, and he's still not finishing. And at one point, he came to Rav Dinkevich, and Rav Dinkevich answered him an answer which at the time, I must have been too young or inexperienced to appreciate what Rav Dinkevich said to him. Rav Dinkevich said to him, in life, sometimes that is the challenge a person has. Dealing with the fact that I don't know why it's taking me longer. And in the here and now, I don't have a solution. But in the long run, Bezrat Hashem, you'll finish your process. The thing that's bothering you now is that you see people all around you, he finished, and you're still here. But let's think 10 years down the road. If you'll all have had your gear, you had it a month later, they had it a month earlier, does it really matter? It matters to you now, because right now you have that tension. You shouldn't look at anyone else. You're in your process, and for whatever reason, Hashem is giving you a challenge in the way your process is evolving. So Moshe Rabbeinu is seeing how he was supposed to help the Jews get out of Egypt, and in the here and now what he sees is things got really, really worse, and the Jews don't like him. And they're very upset at him. So when Moshe Rabbeinu saved the Jew's life and paid the price that the Jew spoke badly about him and caused him to spend most of his life in exile, that Moshe Rabbeinu handled. But when Moshe Rabbeinu comes and tries to help the Jews the way Hashem told him, and he sees the direct outcome is that the Jews are suffering, and they come back to him and they say, Hashem should judge you. You made it so much worse for us because you came. Now they're killing us. So now Moshe feels bad and he turns to Hashem. He feels it's his responsibility to plead their case. And so he says, Hashem, what'd you send me for? And Hashem says, you want to understand the now. Avraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov never asked me to understand the now. They had their challenges. And they never challenged me. They never came back and said, you know, God, you said I would have a son, and I haven't had a son in all these years. They never challenged me and said, Rabbon Shalom, you told me the son was my future, and now you're telling me to offer him as a sacrifice. Rabbon Shalom, you promised me everything would be good, and now Esav's coming to kill me. Rabbon Shalom, you promised me everything would be good, and look, my Yosef disappeared. Rabbon Shalom, you promised me everything would be okay, and look at what happened to Dina. They had many challenges in their life. And they never came back and said to me, well, what about now? And you are. And so the Ribbono Shel Olam says, boy, what a pity we don't have some of the old folks here. And Hashem is really giving it to Moshe Rabbeinu. This is probably one of the harshest criticisms Moshe is going to get. Hashem says, I never let them know. I never had to appear to show them that I tell the truth. And you're challenging me. And you should know that I kept my word to them. I kept my word to the patriarchs, and I'm going to keep my word here. So they're going to come back, the Jews, and just like I kept my word there, I'm going to react. I know the Jews' pain, and tell the Jewish people I'm taking them out of their suffering. And I'm going to save them from this work, and I'm going to redeem them with a powerful hand, and I'm going to really punish the Egyptians and take them to be my nation, and we'll have a special connection, and I'll bring them to the land of Israel. And the Jews aren't listening. Moshe is trying to comfort them, telling them that it's about to get better, and they can't even listen to him. They're working so hard. So this is another important rule, that before things get better, very often they get to their worst. Very often, just when we're ready to give up, that's when things are about to change. That's the challenge of waiting at a bus stop. You guys ever had that? You wait until you decide, that's it, I'm leaving. Yeah, and just when you're far enough away that you can't make that bus, the bus comes. So then you tell yourself, okay, when I'm ready to leave, I'm going to wait. And then it happens when you really leave, right? You're ready to leave and say, I'm going. And they say, no, it'll come right now. So you wait another 2 minutes. And then that time, the bus comes after those 2 minutes, right? You guys, and the same thing happens with the stock market. Most people, they buy high and they sell low. And if they'd wait a little bit, that low would go up. So then some people wait. I bought TCPI at about $2.50, $3. And went up to $5, and it went up to $6. I made a ton of money, only I didn't sell. And then it went down, and an FDA ruling went came out against the drug they were producing, and it went down to $2, to $1, to 90 cents, to 80 cents, and I finally sold it about 14 cents, I think. What a loss. Think about it. You buy a stock at $2, $2.50, and you sell it at about 14 cents. Okay. So I held on to that. It's going to turn around, right? No, it didn't. Don't bother looking it up. TCPI. Coming back to... this goes back before some of you were born. Now it sounds old. At any rate... coming back to our parsha, so the Jewish people have had it. They can't anymore. And Hashem says to Moshe, come to Paro. And you remember the story how Moshe would enter his castle. No one could stop Moshe. The lions that were supposed to attack him would run around like puppy dogs. And when Moshe came, so if you recall, the first time he threw a staff, the staff turned into a snake. And Pharaoh said, you know, you're funny. This is a city where we all do magic. He calls his little kids. He says, do it. And they throw their sticks and they all become snakes. He calls his wives. He says, do it. They throw their sticks. They all become snakes. And then he calls the sorcerers. He says, you want to see? They'll do it too. And they throw their sticks and they become snakes. And then Aaron's snake becomes a stick. And then it starts moving around and swallowing up all the other snakes. So then they have nothing to say. And this is going to be the game that Hashem plays with Pharaoh and his sorcerers. Hashem repeatedly brings them to his court and then shows them how they can't do it. And Hashem purposely lets them first feel like they can do it. Oh, who has a watch? Can I borrow your watch? Show you a neat thing. I'd rather his watch. You'll understand why later. Thank you. Okay. It's important when you teach things to kids to show it to them in a way that they'll remember. So last week's parsha, I forgot to show you. There's an illustration. Our teachers taught us that you can make your hand seem like it extends. Batya went to reach for Moshe's casket and she couldn't reach. And then her hand got longer and longer and longer till she reached the casket, right? So I still remember the teacher doing this, so that then it you retain it, then you remember it. So it's very important when we teach to use methods that the kids will remember. Okay? Those who have the vaccine here, just be quiet, okay? You never do a magic trick with a vaccine driver, right? So you could hold your wrist really, really well. And then, when you hold your wrist really, really well, the pen doesn't fall, right? You know this trick, right? You just don't tell anyone what you're doing, and then you do it, right? But Benny is telling me that I sort of gave it away. Right? So what's the trick in this? That when you push your finger against it, you do this, okay? So everyone's sure you did it one way, and really you didn't. Why did I need your watch? Okay? Okay, but you begin by showing the finger. So everyone's like, oh, I can do that too. And then you go, really? Okay? Now, that's what Hashem did to Pharaoh's men. Right? He did each plague in a way where they said, we can do it too. What I'm saying now is the Ramban. If you could pass him back his watch, please. The Ramban says, why did Hashem do things that they could replicate? Because if Hashem would start off with things they couldn't replicate, then they'd just sit back and say, yeah, I could do that. I'm just not going to bother. I could. Like this, Hashem brought them to the court. They threw their staffs. They became snakes. They became snakes. Then Hashem outdid them. They, Hashem did the blood. They said, we can do that too. Then Hashem said, okay, but you won't be able to do Kenim. Dam Tzverdea, we can do. I can do that too. Each time Pharaoh shows how he can do it too. Then Hashem brings them to Kenim and they say, I can't. I can't. This is God. And our goal, as we said in the beginning, Hashem says, the goal is to reach a point where the Egyptians will say Hashem is right. Now, there's another concept here that's mentioned in the Kuzari and in the Ramban, and that is Egypt was the metropolis. Egypt was the place where you had the most sorcery, you had the top pagan sleight of hand, sorcerers, everything. Egypt was the top. So, in Egypt had the top education, and Egypt had the top priests. So Hashem purposely put us there. And if they will come out and say, Hashem is running the show, then the whole world has to accept it. And that's why it has to happen in Egypt, that has evolved economically, has evolved in their day scientifically, has evolved with their development of all the different medicines and sorceries, and then they come out and they say, no, this isn't any of that. This is God. Oh, okay, now you've won. You take the right opponent, then the world has to accept it. Yes?
I've always found difficulty in that answer, in the sense that despite all that, Pharaoh didn't let the Egyptians go, didn't let the Jews go. Even in the first half of the plague, that God didn't harden his heart. The Jews, 40 days after being in the desert, 40 days after they were about to the Torah, they completely forget about that, and they sin with the golden calf. I mean, the Kuzari says that it was common knowledge back then, but I mean, I don't know how much of is God trying to prove a point here? What was the saying? Was he like, it seems like he was playing with it.
There are two ways I could answer you. One will probably sit better with you, but it's not so nice. So I'm going to go the second way. Okay?
I don't mind the first one.
How do you know?
Even if you don't mind, I have to be nice. So let's imagine a person who is sitting 10 minutes before Mincha, and a new student walks into Machon Meir. And the new student says, what's next? And so this person says, we're going to pray in 10 minutes. And so the new student says, why are you praying? So the student of the Machon says, well, let me explain to you. And he sits there and he spends 10 minutes explaining there's a God, he created the world, he created a system, he says, talk to me, I know what you want, but show me that you know that I run the world and I'll help you. And so we have to have intent in our prayer, and we have to, and our prayer has meaning, and Hashem created the world so that there will be that connection between us and Hashem in our prayer. He gives a beautiful class. Right, Rav Bigun is sitting behind him, and when he's done, he gives him a pat on the back, and he says, wow, wow. Now, let's fast forward 2 minutes. The same one who gave that class is now standing in Shmona Esrei. He just explained to someone the importance of prayer, the meaning of prayer. Will he have intent in every word? Will he be able to live up to what he just said? Wait a second, conceptually understood it. He even taught it. But where is he? You're saying the Egyptians saw it. It was clear to them. So then how come their behavior did not reflect what they understood? We also see things and understand them and even teach them and then find ourselves challenged with living up to them. I speak for myself. Okay? There's a reality where we can conceptualize and understand things, and then we have to live with the reality. Should I cheat on my taxes or not? Of course I shouldn't. But does that mean it's easy every time to catch A and B and C and D and E and F? So that's a recurring theme in our existence. We have what we believe in, or we have what we've come to understand, and then can we live up to that? And we all live that contradiction. So to ask it about the Egyptians, I'm not sure how much of a question that is. I'm really not sure. I mean, so forever the world knows that Hashem got involved. Meaning, it's enough for Hashem to get involved once in a massive way, the way he did here. And then from then on, Hashem says, I'm not telling you I get involved every day. I'm telling you I'm running the show, I'm following the show. If Hashem shows up to Eov and says, hey, I'm here, I've been watching, I know everything you've gone through. Even if Eov doesn't understand Hashem's calculations, he lives in a world where he understands Hashem's involved, Hashem's spoken to him. So that appearance of a one time in history in Egypt and then Sinai gives us the ability ever since to have a knowledge. Hashem's following what's going on. Hashem does not say, what I did in Egypt, I'll do in Auschwitz. He doesn't say that. Hashem does not say, here, what you've seen me do here, anytime you're in trouble, guys, I'll come down. I'll make it happen for you. No, he doesn't say that.
Doesn't he, though? Yeah, sure, yeah.
It's a long discussion.
And then what you just said, I don't want to go on a tangent, but it's like, it kind of sounds like Ashgacha Pratit isn't super Pratit. It's more like a pilot sitting in a cockpit on autopilot. Like the pilot's there, but he's drinking coffee.
Okay, I agree with the first thing you said. I don't either want to go on a tangent. Coming back to our parsha. The question is a great question. It's a tangent, you're right. Coming back to our parsha. So, Hashem tells Moshe, tell Pharaoh to send the Jews. Moshe tells Hashem, the Jews aren't listening to me. How will Pharaoh listen to me? Look at me, I have a speech impediment. So Moshe automatically assumes it's his fault that things haven't been working until now. That's a weakness we have. We tend to assume when things go wrong, it's my fault they went wrong. Even here, Moshe assumes it's his fault things went wrong. And it's not true. We have to recognize it's a weakness. Sometimes that's where friends can help us. That's where spouses can help us. Sometimes as a friend, we have to know our role. Sometimes we shouldn't hide the truth from someone. Sometimes we have to help a person see that it's not all their fault. It's a balancing act, and the question is, where does the truth lie? We don't always know. We have a recounting of the genealogy of Moshe and Aaron. Aaron marries Elisheva, the daughter of Aminadav, the sister of Nachshon, right, a descendant of Yehuda. Elazar will take from the daughters of Putiel, what you mentioned earlier tonight. We have a man named Korach. We're going to meet up with him. He is a relative of Moshe Rabbeinu's, a cousin. And he has children. Elazar marries the daughters of Yisro. And the daughters of Yisro are called Benot Putiel. Why is he called Putiel? Because he was very strong in bringing sacrifices. Puti is to fatten up, patam, to fatten up animals, and he would fatten up animals to bring an honor of pagan gods. That's where Yisro was holding. And Elazar marries his daughter. Okay, we will revisit that later on in the Torah, that Moshe married his daughter and Elazar married his daughter. She wasn't. He married a different daughter. He married his aunt's sister. It's his aunt's sister. Moshe married Elazar. No, Elazar is Aaron's son. Aaron's son.
Moshe's son is Eliezer.
Right.
Aunt's daughter is Korach.
No, he married his aunt Tzipora's sister. Okay. Correct. So Moshe and Aaron are equated in our parsha, and there are different opinions among our sages whether they're equal or not. We begin. Hashem sends Moshe and says, tell him I'm running the world. And what? It's an important message, because Paro was telling people he ran the world. And Moshe continues arguing. He says, my lips don't work well. I can't communicate well. How will Pharaoh listen to me? So Hashem tells Moshe, I have made you in charge of him. You are going to beat him up. Now, this is the reality that is playing itself out. That's a recurring scene. It's deja vu from what happened with Sarah. Our sages say when Sarah was abducted by Pharaoh, and then that night an angel came and she tell him, hit him here. He'd hit him here. Hit him there. Hit him there. That was foreshadowing of what would happen now. So Hashem's telling Moshe, you're going to be like your grandmother. Like Sarah, you're going to be able to punish Paro. Aaron will represent you. Okay? Hashem warns him, I'm going to harden Paro's heart. He won't agree. And this way there will be many miracles in Egypt. And I will destroy Egypt this way. So what's the idea here? What does that mean? Hashem will harden Paro's heart. Okay, so what's the problem with this? We're supposed to have free will. If we don't have free will, then what's the point of living here? Right? I'm supposed to have free will to decide whether I'm doing mitzvot or not. If Hashem hardens a person's heart, so then what did He create me for? If He doesn't let me make my own choices? Yes, fair question, obvious question. Now we're going to visit a few answers. Answer number one is Rambam in his introduction to Pirkei Avos. Rambam says, this is similar to my example. You're sitting in the car, you're sitting at the Shabbos table, and what we call our boy, Nachman, what we call our girl, Fagi. Nachman sits next to Fagi, and as she leans over to drink from her soup, he takes her ponytail and dips it in the soup. Then he turns around. You watch him do that. And a second later, Fagi's dripping on her shoulder, and she goes, how'd my ponytail go into my soup? And you're about to burst out laughing, but you realize you shouldn't let Nachman get away with that. So you look at him, and he's like, I don't know. And you go, right, I do know. A minute later, Fagi's eating her soup, and Nachman takes his tzitzis, and he wiggles it inside her ear. She thinks there's a fly there, so she starts doing this. And every time he brings a dish to the table, as he leans over to put the dish on the table, he sticks his tzitzis into her ear, and she... So you see him teasing her again. Finally, she turns around and she sees him as he's doing it. She says, Nachman, stop. And he goes, oh, I'm sorry. And you're looking at him going, really, he's sorry. And this is going on throughout the meal. Every 2 seconds, Nachman finds another way to annoy Fagi. They're sitting at the table and he suddenly moves her chair. So now she's a little bit further from her food. She's not so happy with him, right? And it's going on again and again and again until finally you say, Nachman, this isn't going to happen. You have to stop bothering your sister. She doesn't have to suffer just because she's sitting next to you. And then it happens a second time and a third time. And you keep warning him until finally you say, Nachman, you're going to have to leave the table. You can't sit here and drive your sister crazy. You know what? Switch seats. You switch him to the other side of the table. And a second later, he's finding another way to annoy her. She's sitting and eating her plate, and he's pushing her so that her plate almost falls onto her lap. So Nachman is intent on annoying Fagi, right? There will come a point where you're going to tell Nachman, I've had it. And you're going to do something, whatever you think is fair. Whether it's removing from the Shabbos table, whether it's depending on the age and the behavior, you're going to punish him. You're going to react. What happens if at that point you've had a tremendous amount of patience and at that point Nachman goes, I'm sorry, I want to apologize. So you can imagine that at one level you might say, okay, apologize and stop. But then at another level, there will come a point where you'll say, no more apologies, it's over. Now you're going to pay the price for what you did. And Nachman will say, but I want to say I'm sorry. And you'll say, I'm not accepting it at this point. You've had your chance, you've had your chance again, you've had your chance again. At this point, it's over. Now you're going to pay for what you did. Rambam says that's what it means, Hashem hardened Paro's heart. That there comes a point where the punishment is, I'm not letting you take it back, you're going to live with the consequences. You did this, now you're going to pay the price. And so, the first 5 plagues, Hashem doesn't harden Paro's heart. The first 5 plagues, Paro could have said, go. And he promises he will say go. And he doesn't. He always goes back on his word. After the first 5 plagues, Hashem says, now you're on for the ride. Strap in. Now you're going. Now you're not going to have an opportunity to say, never mind, you guys can go. Let's stop the game here. No, it's not happening now. Now you're going to play out the full 10 plagues. That's Rambam's interpretation. Others, we have the Rashba, we have the Re'i Ben Shu'ib, we have a few commentaries. Others say, if a person, let's imagine Joey is the bully on the playground. Okay? So Joey's the bully on the playground, and one day Frankie shows up to the playground. Now, Frankie is twice Joey's size. And Frankie sees how Joey's bullying other kids around. So he puts a hand on Joey's shoulder, and he says, "Hey, Joe." And he looks up, and he says, "Yeah, Frankie." He says, "It's not nice to behave that way. You understand me?" And Joey looks at him and says, And then Frank starts squeezing his shoulder. So now Joey looks up at him and he's in pain. And Frank says, "Joey, you're going to say, 'I'm sorry, I won't do it again,' right?" And he's squeezing Joey's shoulder. Joey feels like his shoulder's about to give out. What does Joey do? If he has any sense in his head, he's going to say, "I'm sorry, it's wrong, I won't do it again." Does he mean it? No. But he wants to stop being in pain, right? So there's a certain logic you should have that says, if I'm losing and I'm suffering, I might as well give in. So what Rashba and his students say is that until the fifth plague, if Paro would have wanted to say, "God, you're the one in charge, I give in, the Jews can go," even if he didn't mean it, if he was just doing it to save his hide, he could have done that. From the fifth plague onward, Hashem said, "You didn't do it until now. Now I will not allow you to have the logic to say that." That's what the advisors come in on the seventh plague and say to Paro, "Don't you realize we're losing? Don't you realize there's going to be nothing left of Egypt?" Philosophically, you could say what you want, but you have to deal with reality. We're losing everything. There's going to be nothing left here. They were right. And that's where Hashem hardened his heart. Throughout the 10 plagues, if Paro would have wanted to admit the truth, he could have. But if Paro wants to do that self-preservation act of saying, "I believe, you're the God, I'll do whatever you want," when he doesn't believe, when he's only doing it for self-preservation, that he would no longer be able to do. Once he didn't do it the first 5 plagues, afterwards Hashem says, "Now either you believe it or I'm not going to let you do it." And being that Paro wouldn't believe it, he hardens his own heart and he says no. Hashem says, "Then I'll harden your heart and I won't let you say it just for self-preservation." And then the hardening of the heart was not to let him say it as self-preservation. But if he ever wanted to do tshuva and say, "I know you're God and I'm going to do what you want," that he could have always done. When Hashem hardened his heart, he wouldn't let him do what he should have logically done, and that is for self-preservation, say it. Yes? Right, partial tshuva. You're almost the boss. You're almost in charge. I'm almost going to listen to you. I'm going to live conditions. Why was Nagasaki bombed? Yeah. He wasn't given that opportunity. He was given that opportunity until then. There comes a point where Hashem says, "You should have done it by now, and you're choosing not to. And at this point, you better do it. And if you're not doing it, I'm not going to accept half answers." You have to remember, he slaughtered 300 Jewish babies a day for his own bath. We're not talking about a simple person here. Nagasaki was bombed because after Hiroshima, the United States said, "Okay, let's sign a peace treaty." And Japan started making arguments about what would be in the peace treaty. And the United States said, "You're not going to give us conditions. And if you do, you're going to get another one." And when Japan wouldn't listen, they bombed Nagasaki. Now, the argument goes, the human rights people say, that it didn't have to play itself out that way. That the United States wanted to experiment. They didn't finish their experimentation, and that's why they bombed Nagasaki. They were looking for an excuse. I have no way of knowing that. How would I know? Yes. Yes, sir. I can't hear you. Thank you. If we'll say again, Chazal learned he didn't die, that he got leprosy, and then that's the idea that he died. But if we'll say that he died, so then according to that, the Medrash says he died, a new Pharaoh arose, the Jews hoped that with a new Pharaoh things would be better, and they only got worse. That's why you see the Jews were wiped. At that point, Hashem says, I heard their cry. That's when they turned to Hashem. Why? Because they had hope that it was only the first Pharaoh's wickedness. The next one's going to be okay. And he wasn't. He ended up being worse. And don't forget, he had the first five plagues to change his mind. He was given opportunity. He chose to say no. So, part of what's going to happen now is Hashem's going to show the Egyptians and the Jewish people who's boss. So if the Egyptians believed the Nile was boss, the first thing that's going to happen is Moshe's going to hit the Nile. And if the Egyptians threw girls into the Nile, every time they thought they needed to bring a sacrifice, they would take a virgin girl and drown her in the Nile and say that's a sacrifice to the Nile. And then they said, now we have to sacrifice babies to the Nile. And so they tossed the Jewish boys. And then they said, we have to sacrifice the Jewish boys and the non-Jewish boys. So now Moshe is showing them how the Nile suddenly turns to blood. The 10 plagues will correspond to 10 decrees the Egyptians did to the Jews. One of the ways the Egyptians wanted to stop procreation by the Jews, they knew that Jews wouldn't be intimate with their wives if after the wife's menstruation, she doesn't immerse in a mikveh. She doesn't, for whatever reason, the Jews were keeping this back then. Ramban says not only Jews were keeping this, it was a cultural thing, it was something that was kept already from the days of, maybe from the days of Adam. That when a woman has her period, afterwards she immerses in a mikvah, she goes to a stream or something, immerses, and only after that her husband will be intimate with her. So what Pharaoh did was, he forbade the women from bathing. And this way the men wouldn't come close to their wives. So he forbade them from bathing, and this would help stem the procreation in Judaism. That was his goal. And that's why what Hashem did was he prevented them from bathing. They wanted a husband to feel like his wife never finished with her blood, so Hashem made it that their Nile never finished with its blood. There are 7 days, so Hashem made it 7 days that the Nile was bloody. Rashi's pshat is that the Medrash says that any cup an Egyptian held with water turned to blood. A Jew held that same cup, it turned to water. If a Jew and an Egyptian would take a reed and drink from the same cup, the Egyptian would get blood, the Jew would get water. The Egyptian would tell the Jew, hold this. The Jew would hold it, it would be water. The Egyptian would take a straw and try to drink from it, in his mouth it would turn to blood. So, unless he paid the Jew for that water, it would always be blood. That's the Medrash, that's how Rashi goes. If they tried digging wells, all the water in Egypt turned to blood. So that's the Medrash Rashi goes with. That's what your kids will come home with. If the Egyptian paid the Jew for water, he could have water. So the Jews start making money. They start having this concept that they're allowed to own money. That they are autonomous people. Okay. So Pharaoh's been warned, and he doesn't heed the warnings, and so Aaron hits the Nile, and it turns to blood. All the fish in the Nile die. The Egyptians believed the Nile was their god. Suddenly the Nile can't protect itself, right? The Nile can... one of the brilliant things Hashem is doing here is he keeps warning them, this is what I'm going to do. Pharaoh says, he's God, stop me. Your sorcerers are so great, stop me. Moshe walks in and says, this is what's going to happen tomorrow. All of Pharaoh and all of his advisors are there. They can't stop him. So now they're faced with a philosophical quandary. What are they supposed to say? They believe the Nile is God. The Nile can't stop God. They believe the cow is God, but the cow can't stop God. So what's going on here? Who's the God? Pharaoh's the God? So then how come Pharaoh can't stop all these plagues? Now suddenly being the God becomes a challenge. Until now it was, I'm the God, you all can listen to me. I'm the God, you're all going to do what I say. Moshe catches Pharaoh often when he's going to the bathroom. At the crack of dawn, Pharaoh would go outside into the Nile, make believe he was praying, and do his needs in the Nile. He would be the only one, I guess, who would walk into the Nile. He's a god, the Nile's a god, he could walk into the Nile. So he did his needs in the Nile. And then no one knew, and he'd never go to the bathroom. So this is... The Medrash says this is part of what Hashem is showing the Egyptians. Ordinarily, you fight your enemy, the last thing you do is show that your game plan before them. This is what I'm going to do to you. And Hashem says, I'm telling you exactly what I'm about to do. I'm going to turn your Nile into blood. And they can't stop. And so the Nile turns to blood. Moshe does not hit the Nile. One of the traits we will see from Moshe is Hakarat HaTov, having appreciation. Let's stop and ask ourselves a question in all honesty. How many people do we owe, and how much do we owe them? I'm not talking about money. For the kindness they did in our lives. Let's take an accounting for a second. Okay, there are our parents. Of course, we have claims on them. They shouldn't have done this. They should have done that. Every normal person has their issues, why they think their parents should have been different. But at the end of the day, we owe them something. There's that wonderful teacher you had in first grade or second grade or third grade. How many people are there in your lives that you owe something to? Be honest. If you had to ask yourself, how many people do you owe something to the point where you shouldn't do something that seems like you did something against them? Let's say they asked you as a security question, tell me which was the school you hated most. And you can't think of a name. So you think my elementary school. You're going to give your elementary school. Can you write that? Or would you say, they gave me something, I shouldn't write my elementary school? I understand when we're little kids, we like saying we hate school. But now, looking back, and here the question is, can we really have appreciation for what was given to us? The greater a person is, the more they have appreciation. The more honest a person is, the more humble they're going to be, because the more they recognize how their success is contingent on a lot of other people. I teach a great class, maybe. But I wouldn't be able to teach a class if you weren't here. And I wouldn't be able to teach a class if Machon Meir wasn't here. And Machon Meir wouldn't be here if not for Rav Bigon and Dani Sharchaton and a whole bunch of Rav Listman. There's a lot that goes on here that I couldn't do. There's that wonderful webcam, this microphone. There's Michael Arosh who runs it all. There are a lot of people to say thank you to at the end of the day. The more honest we're going to be, the more we realize I'm only a small component of any success, of any good thing that goes on. And how long do we remember that? So usually we remember it, we don't even think it. And when we remember it, it lasts about a half a second. How about 80 years? 80 years ago, Moshe Rabbeinu was in the Nile. He heard the story, he can't remember it. The Nile was where he floated. So for 80 years, he looks at the Nile and says, that saved my life. Killed a lot of other Jews, but it saved my life. How many people leave a country and speak badly about the country? A person can say, I hate that language, I hate that culture, people over there are dishonest, immoral, unethical, all kinds of negative things. Well, I'm sure Moshe Rabbeinu could have said many more negative things about the Nile, but no, he's not going to hit the Nile. I would have hit the Nile. I would have said, I'll hit the Nile a million times. This Nile killed so many Jewish babies, of course I'll hit the Nile. How many people could say, I can't hit that Nile, it saved my life? And the same goes for many things in our lives. People leave chutzarts and very often, oh, they're against it. I often say, if we have students that leave Machon Meir and decide they're going to join a different way of life, that's their prerogative. But they should at least see the positive that they got here. Even if a person walks away and says it should have been different this way and that way and another way, fine. We're not worse than the Nile, right? Don't hit us. Saying where the Nile killed millions of Jewish babies. And yet Moshe says, but to me, save my life. I can't hit the Nile. I can't turn it to blood. Aaron will turn it to blood. So Aaron hits the Nile and it turns to blood. Pharaoh isn't interested. So Pharaoh goes home. He's not interested. The Egyptians have to deal with 7 days of the Nile being blood. Hashem sends Moshe to Pharaoh. Tell him, Hashem says, send my nation. I want them to serve me. If you refuse, you're going to be plagued with Tsefardim. What are Tsefardim? So your kids will come home and tell you frogs. And everyone knows Tsefardim are frogs. Everyone that is, except for the commentaries. Not everyone agrees that Tsefardim are frogs. Some say that Tsefardim are crocodiles. It's a little bit of a different plague, right? a little different. Okay, yeah. So the Egyptians believed that they were the Garden of Eden. They looked at the Nile, and the Nile would naturally have no bugs, no vermin. The Nile didn't have harmful creatures in it. So they said, if we have the Nile, that's why we have such wonderful air in Egypt, and because we worship the shape of the sheep, that's why things are right in Egypt. So Hashem first makes the Nile turn to blood. You thought the Nile was the source of the blessing in your life? Look at what the Nile's become now. Next, Hashem takes the Nile and makes the Nile produce vermin that are destroying their lives. They kept saying, we have this wonderful clean water supply, and the Nile is our blessing, the Nile is our source of life. Hashem made it that the Nile would produce the frogs that would come out and plague the country. These frogs were abnormal. These frogs would jump into a burning hot oven. The Egyptians couldn't go to sleep at night. They'd be jumping in their beds, under their beds, into their mouths, into their ears. They'd try to eat and they'd be jumping into their mouths. Little frogs. I went back to frogs. No. First of all, alligators are very little. Have you seen little alligators?
They could be this big. But if Pharaoh's the size of a Coke bottle, who knows?
Right. Okay, I'm going back to what's generally known, and that is that it's frogs. things are getting very bad in Egypt. Because, I don't know if you guys have ever been infested with anything, but we once had a dead cat in the miklat. I went down to see what was going on, and the dead cat had a bunch of fleas on it. When I walked back into the house got plagued with fleas. Now, all it took was that, visiting the miklat, and I feel like things are jumping all over me. And I became the host. And I walked back in and I said, my wife, I have to take a shower. And that was my mistake. I shouldn't have walked into the house. And the house became infested. And that night, we couldn't sleep. I mean, we had every second we're getting bitten. Now, that's tiny compared to what the Egyptians had. You know, a little flea here and a little flea there. The Egyptians had nowhere to run. I'm saying you could only leave the country. Could you imagine being in bed and feeling these things crawling all over you, jumping all over you, making noise? And there was so much noise in Egypt, you couldn't hear a person talk. Meaning all around you, you heard the frogs. It was a deafening noise. So it was painful to live in Egypt. Suddenly Egypt, that was the land that they said, this is the Garden of Eden on planet Earth, suddenly becomes something else. They can't make any food. They have dead frogs in their food. Everywhere you look, you have frogs. So, one Medrash says, because the Pasuk says, the Tzifardea, the frog, came out over Egypt, so there's a Medrash, there's an opinion in the Medrash that says, one massive frog came out of the Nile, and they tried to beat it. So every time they'd hit it, a bunch of little frogs would come out. And that's, so you have this Godzilla hopping around Egypt, right? A massive frog and little frogs coming out. That's according to that Midrash. So this time, Pharaoh's singing a different tune. He summons Moshe and Aaron and he says, pray to Hashem, let him remove the frogs from me and my nation, and then I'll send the nation and they will sacrifice. So Moshe tells Pharaoh, let's show off. Make it hard on me. When do you want the frogs to leave? Pharaoh hears that. Pharaoh is such a con artist, Pharaoh is convinced. Moshe is asking me because he knows this plague is about to end. You remember what we discussed earlier tonight? Just when we hit our breaking point, very often things are about to change. So Pharaoh says he must know that the plague's about to end right now. So Pharaoh says, tomorrow. So Moshe says, fine, like you said, tomorrow. And now you'll see that Hashem runs the show and no one's like Hashem. This isn't the game. So
it was meant to end it.
It could have ended either way. Another opinion says that Pharaoh thought the earliest time, he didn't think I could ask God to make it happen now. He thought the earliest time he could say is tomorrow. So he said tomorrow. So Moshe says, fine, then tomorrow it'll be, as you said. So they leave. Moshe prays that tomorrow the frogs will leave. And the frogs die. And all over Egypt you have piles and piles of rotting frogs. And Pharaoh sees, that's not so bad. It'll pass. We can get rid of it. In my castle I'll have 50 servants clean out the castle. So all around Egypt it's disgusting and smelly. And so Pharaoh doesn't send them. We have an order in the plagues. Two come with a warning, the third is without warning. Two with a warning, and the third is without warning. So we're up to the third plague. And so the third plague is lice. So Moshe is told, he tells Aaron to hit the sand, because again, he has appreciation for the sand. When he was in his time of need, he was in panic. At age 15, he had just killed an Egyptian, so he hit him in the sand. And then he could breathe a sigh of relief. He hit the Egyptian. So he always felt like he owed something to the sand, because the sand saved him. That's very interesting to me, because a day later he was in trouble all over again. So it was a very short-lived rescue that the sand afforded him. So if we go with our simple understanding of the story, and that is that Pharaoh never caught him, he escaped, then we could understand that the sand gave him that buffer where he could escape before he was caught. But if the understanding is like the Medrash, that he was summoned into Pharaoh's court, he was put on death row, he was taken in to be executed, and then there was a miracle and he was able to escape, so then you really have to wonder how Moshe had a kar sato for the sand that supported him for one day to hide the Egyptian. I'm not so sure what Chazal were telling us in that. It's not clear to me. I would have greater appreciation for the sand because I stand on it. There are other things to say thank you to the sand for. I'm not sure why that was the great appreciation. Okay, so Aaron turns the sand into kinim, into lice. And so now the Egyptian sorcerers try, and ordinarily they should have been able to do it, but they couldn't. And so they tell Pharaoh, this is a finger of God. Pharaoh hardens his heart. So everyone's suffering. Hashem tells Moshe, go to Pharaoh early. He's going out to the water. Tell him, Hashem says, let my nation go. Let them serve me. Because if you don't, I'm going to send against you wild animals. So the Egyptians suffered from the lice. And Pharaoh, on this one, just like on the first one, doesn't give in. So there's no conversation. They suffer, the plague ends. But there's a long period that everyone's suffering. You guys ever see lice?
Yes.
So, okay. So, they're like fleas. They're a little different. They walk very slowly. But they fall into your food. They're all over. Okay, they're suffering, but Pharaoh's okay. The only thing is, Pharaoh's suffering too. Meaning, the plagues were in a way that Pharaoh couldn't escape. You know, if the Nile is all bloody, how's he taking his shower? And it's not only the economy now. If there are frogs in his castle, and frogs jumping into his mouth, he's suffering too. And if there are lice all over, then Pharaoh's sitting there like this also, right? It's plaguing everyone. But he doesn't give in. So the next plague is Arov. Wild animals are going to storm Egypt. And there will be no escape. And on this plague, the Pasuk says, the Jews won't suffer from this. So the Medrash says, on all the plagues, the Jews didn't suffer. The commentaries don't all agree on that. There's an opinion that says the first three, the Jews also suffered. It's only from this plague onward that the Jews were separate. So the next day, wild animals come. Lions and tigers and bears and elephants and rhinoceros and snakes and scorpions. And the Gemara says there's this animal that has a very long arm, and the Egyptians would run into their houses and lock the doors, and this animal was able to stick its hand in through the chimney or through the door and unlock the door, and they'd come in. Anyways, they had snakes there and scorpions. What? And when you have a rhinoceros stampeding, I don't know that Egyptian houses could handle that. And when you have a elephant stampeding, I don't think Egyptian houses could handle that. So Pharaoh calls Moshe and Aaron. Everything's getting destroyed. You have stampedes, wild animals coming and devouring the people. And he says, go bring your sacrifices right here, right now. Maybe your sacrifices, maybe he thought their sacrifices would stop it. Moshe says, we can't do that. We're going to slaughter the Egyptian animal that you all worship. We can't do that. The Egyptians would kill us. We have to walk 3 days' journey. And there we can be confident we could slaughter your God and no one will come and harm us. So Pharaoh says, okay, I'll let you go. Just don't go too far away and pray for me. We're being destroyed. And this is where we'll pick up. This is Hashem on Thursday.